webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment you saw yourself and God and God and you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
If even one is lost, then I lose. So that's why I never gave the human race the right to choose. You were never meant to find the right path on your own. 'Cause I'm the truth and way, and I brought everybody home. So in matters of eternity, a heart and your heart so none would believe, and I blinded your eyes so you could not see all of the joy set before me. I want you to see what the law was given for, condemning everyone so I could redeem all. Risk you spoiling the plan, not when this global rescue mission rested on just one man, bringing a punishment that no sin could avoid, and knowing all would be fulfilled when God's image was destroyed.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for the 15th of August, 2013, from right here in the GR Studios in Nashville, Tennessee. And from Houston, Texas, please welcome from the GR headquarters, the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution, Mr. Michael Williams.
Good evening, Bears.
Good evening. Good evening, Michael.
How are you today?
I can't see my way around. It's so dark. There, I've just turned the lights on. It's okay. I'm fine. Thanks very much, Michael.
Very good. Well, it is a beautiful summer day here in Houston. Occasionally overcast and breezy. It's just one of those days.
And today in Nashville, mate, it's like one of those days that makes you glad to be alive. Filtered light dropping down on the green leaves of the trees in the front yard, and it's just gorgeous. It's beautiful. I want to live here forever. No, I don't.
Yes, marvelous.
I don't. Yes, I do.
Compared to the options?
Oh, I got some options.
So stick around for the show where we reckon that the Scottish poet William Drummond had it about right when he said, "He that cannot reason is a fool. He that will not reason is a bigot. He that dare not reason is a slave."
Day there's none accusing you, but the religion bearing my name is just so far from the truth. You are humanity that never was before. You are mankind that's never sinned, 'cause you've never been under the law. But Christianity lied to you, said you're justified by the things you do. It's saying there's a judgment coming soon, so it's judging the work of Calvary too. Saying my blood wasn't good enough, saying I'm coming back to clean up. Saying it's just like it was before, saying I didn't fulfill the law. Well, I've got some very good news, the law and the songs and the prophets too. They speak about me, not about you. The things you've been told are just not true. Do you see now? Is it starting to make sense? You've been taught you're a sinner when you've always been righteous. Or do you see now what the law was given for? Condemning everyone so I could redeem all.
Gospel Revolution.
The Calf Path. One day,
Through the primeval wood, a calf walked home, as good calves should, but made a trail all bent askew, a crooked trail, as all calves do. Since then, 200 years have fled, and I infer the calf is dead, but still he left behind his trail, and thereby hangs my moral tale. The trail was taken up next day by a lone dog that passed that way, and then a wise bellwether sheep pursued the trail o'er vale and steep, and drew the flock behind him too, as good bellwethers always do. And from that day o'er hill and glade, through these old woods a path was made, and many men wound in and out, and dodged and turned and bent about, and uttered words of righteous wrath, because 'twas such a crooked path. But still they followed, do not laugh, the first migrations of that calf, and through this winding woodway stalked, because he wobbled when he walked. This forest path became a lane that bent and turned again. This crooked lane became a road where many a poor horse with his load toiled on beneath the burning sun and travelled some 3 miles in one, and thus a century and a half they trod the footsteps of that calf. The years passed on in swiftness fleet. The road became a village street, and this, before men were aware, a city's crowded thoroughfare, and soon the central street was this of a renowned metropolis, and men 2 centuries and a half trod in the footsteps of that calf. Each day 100,000 a rout followed the zigzag calf about, and o'er his crooked journey went the traffic of a continent. 100,000 men were led by one calf near 3 centuries dead. They followed still his crooked way and lost 100 years a day, for thus such reverence is lent to well-established precedent. A moral lesson this might teach, were I ordained and called to preach, for men are prone to go it blind along the calf paths of the mind, and work away from sun to sun to do what other men have done. They follow in the beaten track, and out and in and forth and back, and still their devious course pursue to keep the path that others do. But how the wise old wood gods laugh who saw the first primeval calf. Ah, many things this tale might teach, but I'm not ordained to preach.
Michael, have you had an interesting week?
I have indeed. And I do mean that. It's been a very interesting week. I got a call earlier in the week and was informed that my daughter, Audrey, my youngest daughter.
This is a daughter that you took to a funeral museum, right? A coffin museum once.
Yes, and we both enjoyed it thoroughly. We just had a blast there.
And she's coming back for more.
She's coming back, and she was bringing the gentleman that she has been dating now for over a year. So I had some suspicions as to what might be up, but I wasn't sure. I'd never met this fellow before. So they drove all night and arrived here on Friday morning at about 9 o'clock in the morning, actually. And I knew that he had to be back to work on Monday morning, so I knew this was something more than just, you know, it'd be nice to see Dad weekend. So, and as it turned out, Barris, they'd come here with the purpose. He told me that he wanted to talk to me. So sure enough, yesterday we sat down and Audrey dismissed herself to go take a nap, and he and I sat here in the living room and talked, and he told me that he would be very honored if I would approve of his marrying my daughter.
Now tell me, and you made him suffer for a moment or two.
Well, Actually, I did. I think that I talked for about 45 minutes and asking questions. And at some point, I stopped and I told him, I said, you know, I really appreciate this. I know that you guys getting married certainly would not be predicated upon my approval. But I said, I do appreciate that. But I still had not at that time given my approval. But he convinced me he was in love with my little girl.
Now, and this is Audrey, your youngest.
Yes, Audrey, my baby. And
Hang on. How old is Audrey?
She's 26.
She's your baby.
She's my baby girl.
They never stop being your baby, do they?
Never. My oldest is still my baby. So, Audrey is my baby girl, and I've so wanted to see her to be really happy and find a good relationship. And the person that I met, I was really, really pleased with, seems to be a really fine gentleman. So they haven't really set a date just yet. And I did make it clear to him that the only way that I would give my approval and that I would accept his proposal.
Let me guess. You had to marry him?
Oh, well, that wasn't it at all. No.
Hazel had to say okay?
No, it wasn't that either.
He had to convert, is that it?
He didn't have to do that.
Dang.
I had to have an absolute firm guarantee of grandchildren as soon as possible.
That's funny.
I told him, I said, if you're not going to produce grandchildren from me, you serve no purpose whatsoever.
I love it. What did his face look like when you said that?
Well, when Audrey came back in the room, he actually went in and woke her up and came in and I had us a drink and we did a little toast with the drink. And so Audrey says, so I'm taking it that you said yes. And Jason says, well, actually, I got a little more than his approval.
I like this kid already.
So, yes, we're very delighted to welcome him into the family. And he doesn't know what all he's in for. Of course, my daughter knows all of her aunts and uncles in Tennessee, but we're going to give him the full indoctrination with a trip to Tennessee next this coming spring. So,
where is his boy from?
He's from Southern Illinois.
And you're going to expose him to Eastern Tennessee.
To East Tennessee and the Williams family, seventh and eighth generations of Tennesseans to live there.
You're just a regular little sadist, aren't you?
When you're feeling down or you got the case of the blues, why don't you listen to the Gospel Revolution?
Gospel Revolution.
Michael, I thought that this week we would have a chat about something which is dear to my heart, and is the history of Christianity. In the show notes I've sent you, I outlined a brief history of the early church. The early church fascinates me, Michael, because there is so much that we know and there is so much we don't know. For example, we don't know the names of the people who carried on the tradition from, say, Paul and the apostles through to the end of the first century. We know that there was John, the apostle. We know that one of his disciples was named Polycarp, and there was some kind of continuum happening there. But generally speaking, there is this period of time that we don't know a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
But we know enough about it to know this. Without any question of doubt, those first couple of centuries were predominated by believers in universal redemption. That is to say, the redemption of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The gospel of grace and peace as Paul taught it. So what I thought I'd do is I just outline a brief historical
a look at the first few centuries after Christ.
From AD 33, when Jesus died and was resurrected. And this is by no means comprehensive or complete. It just is a few high points that I've chosen to look at. In Acts 10, we have the vision that Peter had. He's sitting out on the roof and he's hungry. So, I mean, he's already predisposed to thinking about food. But Peter sees this sheet being let down out of heaven, and in it is all kind of animals. For the Jewish mind, there were clean animals, there were unclean animals and so forth. This is 14 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. Now, it's interesting because when we read Acts, we're inclined to think, well, it was just the next year. But it was 14 years later. What
yes.
happened in those 14 years, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
In 15 years after the death, burial of Jesus, the Epistle of James was written. Now, James was an interesting cove because the Ebionite church still refer to James as being their founder and their great saint. The Epistle of James was written in about 48. That's 15 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus. And in that epistle, he cannot help but, whenever he talks about liberty, he has to use the word law. He's very law-minded, to the point where he very much tries to prove that works proves faith in his own epistle. And in doing so, he misrepresents the efforts of Abraham and Rahab and others. The next year, 16
and,
years...
And totally contradicts Paul's statements on the very same characters.
Well, the curious thing, Michael, is that he uses the same words Paul uses in Romans. He says, mm-hmm. O man, who are you,
yes.
O man?
Yes.
A snide remark, really, a kind of a sneaky, backhanded kind of a way of not saying what you really want to say, I suppose. Who are you, O man, to say this? And then, of course, we hear Paul reiterate those very same words back to him in Romans.
But he was the first one to use it because Romans wasn't written for another 7 years. In fact, Galatians was written the next year, AD 49. Romans, where we read that believing is a function of the law and does nothing for you under grace and peace, this was written 23 years after the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. So we've gone from 14 years later with Acts 10 and Peter and his vision, where God tells him, listen, the Gentiles are in on this. To 15 years later where James says, look, I've given, well, he doesn't say I've given up, but I'm reading into this. I've just given up on these Gentiles. I'm writing this epistle to Jews. That's what he says in his intro.
Mm-hmm.
So does Peter, by the way, who writes his epistle 29 years after. But in between those two things, in Acts 21, James, Peter, and John are still not accepting the Hebrew abolition of the first covenant. In is it Hebrews 10, Michael? That it says that the first covenant was abolished,
yes,
abrogated, and nulled. In other words, mm-hmm. they had to be in order for the second one to come.
And Paul affirms those statements in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, where he says that the law has been abolished. And he says it in no uncertain terms. This is fighting mad territory. This is where that... they challenge you. Show me where it says that the law has been abolished. Well, then you show them, and it really doesn't make any difference that you have shown them because they're not going to change their mind.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it really is something. I saw a quote from, I think it was Winston Churchill just the other day, where he said that a fanatic was someone who refuses to change their mind and unable to change the subject. The list that you have here really is quite impressive. The Roman statements, believing is a function of the law, that is one of the best statements I think I've ever seen about believing in context, because it is in the book of Romans that we find out that unbelief is a function of mercy and grace, that mercy and grace are not functions that go along with believing. Mercy and grace are found in the middle of doubt and unbelief. So what you're portraying here for us is the divergence, if you will, from what started out as gospel, at least with Paul. We know it started out as gospel. I don't know that we could say this started out this way with the disciples as gospel. In fact, I think that the disciples actually had this thoroughly messed up for several years before Paul was brought on the scene, to the degree that Paul could not be sent to the disciples to learn the truth. In fact, it's almost like Jesus said, okay, let's get as far away from these guys as we possibly can get so that I can tell you the truth of the gospel and help you understand that here in the Arabian desert.
Well, it was in Acts chapter 21 that James, Peter, and John insisted that Paul, and if not James, Peter, and John, certainly James, and we know that Peter and John were from Galatians chapter 1 and chapter 2, we know that they were seen as pillars of the Jerusalem church, but it was 25 years, a full 25 years, a quarter of a century after the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, that these people were still saying that the Old Testament sacrifices should be made.
Yes, this is true. It's undeniable. It's right there.
Revelations comes a little bit later, 37 years, and I'm just going to relate all of this in years from the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. 37 years later comes the book of Revelation, and that's got some fascinating things in it, mate. Apparently, the people who overcome the devil are going to sing the song of Moses. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. How many Christians today know that, or how many people would have a clue what the song of Moses was, or how the tune went, or what key it's in, or what the second stanza sounds like? I mean, it's and yet we have this put so far in the future that apparently Christians who overcome during this period of destruction are going to know the Song of Moses. In 57 years later, this is after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, 57 years later, 1 John is written. And then we skip forward a century simply because we don't have a lot of information in there, but we do know from Clement of Alexandria, who lived around the 200 mark, 167 years after the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. He was Greek educated, and he said, look, as near as I can tell, the whole world is redeemed. Now, here we come upon the horns of a dilemma, because none of these early church fathers thought that post-mortem punishment was forever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that might sound light, but here is the problem that it brings with us. If post-mortem punishment, and there was this concept of post-mortem punishment, there was a concept of, and it was really the earliest forms of the concept of purgatory. It was temporary, and it was based on the Greek word aeon, or aeonian, which signified a period with a defined end. It was going to last for a certain time, and then it had a predetermined, defined end. It was not an unending period. It was just a period.
Mm-hmm.
So the time of the law, the era of the law, was called an aeon by Jesus in and the disciples in Matthew 24. But Clement of Alexandria was the first person to come at this. And, of course, later he was sainted as a Roman Catholic saint. But then he was later de-sainted because, well, they didn't like that doctrine. Then later, in about the same time, Tertullian, who was one of the first non-Greek educated, in fact pagan educated, church fathers, he was the first guy, by the way, to use the term Trinity, and he decided that hellfire was permanent.
And it must be remembered that the concept of a permanent post-mortem punishment was rooted and grounded in paganism centuries before Christ, where people said, look, for those of us who are really with it, we can understand the nuances and the finer things of philosophy, but for the general masses, the concept of a permanent punishment after life, if they don't do what we tell them, is very useful for keeping them in their place. Now, this was also repeated by Napoleon. This has been around for ages, that concept. Now, from paganism, the concept of a permanent post-mortem punishment made its way into Judaism. In the Old Testament, we see absolutely no concept of a permanent post-mortem punishment. Now, I'm using these words because I want us to kind of, our minds to be able to break through the filters that we've developed through our past indoctrination. There is no concept in the Old Testament like this. Somewhere between the end of the Old Testament and the Gospels, that started 400 years later, we now have a belief in resurrection with the Sadducees and Pharisees. That was what divided them. And we also have a concept of a resurrection to death or to hell or to something really dreadful, along with a resurrection to rewards. This was a very common concept by the time Jesus was on the scene. But it nowhere appears in the Old Testament. People try to make it appear in the Old Testament by using the word Sheol, which in Hebrew means grave, and trying to make that mean hell, but there is no such concept as post-mortem permanent punishment or post-mortem punishment of any kind. In fact, the concept of resurrection was totally unknown in the Old Testament altogether. You see this at its best in the writings of Peter and James and that of Revelation. You don't ever see it in the writings of Paul. But Tertullian, coming back to this Jewish replant from paganism, says, no, it's true. One theologian wrote, Tertullian, an African and a lawyer, dwells with fierce satisfaction on terrible visions of torment.
That's kind of says it. And that's what he was. He was a pagan lawyer who came to agree with Christianity really quite a deal later in life. Another theologian, De Presence, said, "That which strikes us in Clement is his serenity. We feel that he himself enjoys that deep and abiding peace which he urges the Corinthians to seek. We feel that this man had a great love for Jesus Christ. Compare and contrast his serenity and peacefulness with the stormy tempestuousness of Tertullian, his narrow and passionate realism." In this quaint older way of speaking, what they're saying is simply this: Tertullian loved, adored any concept that God would visit severe pain on any of Tertullian's enemies. And there began Christianity's love affair with retribution and vengeance.
In about the same year, about 167 years after the resurrection of Christ, the Alexandrian School of Christian Education, I'm going to call it that because these were called schools, but they were actually universities, I suppose, in today's standard. They were all Greek influenced. And here is an interesting point. The New Testament manuscripts were all written in Greek, and all of the very earliest church fathers spoke and were trained in Greek, with the exception of Tertullian. And they all agreed in their understanding as Greek people, understanding Greek scriptures written in Greek by New Testament writers such as Paul, James, Peter, John, everyone, that the only possible concept was universal redemption, redemption of the world. Now, the curious thing with their concept on post-mortem punishment was this: it was never permanent. It was always temporary. Now, the only way that you can believe in anything but redemption of the world is if you believe post-mortem punishment is permanent. So somewhere it had to be changed from a purgatory kind of a concept to a permanent hell concept. Now, I'm not saying that I believe in purgatory, but I'm mentioning this for a special reason. The Alexandrian School of Christian Education, Michael, was heavily Greek influenced, and the Greek educated people believed in the redemption of the world. And who could most accurately read what the earliest Greek manuscripts meant? Greeks or Latins with a vested interest in formalizing a predetermined doctrine? We're going to find that out about that in a moment. Now, 20 years after this, in about 187 the year 220 AD, there came along a fellow called Origen whose teacher had been Clement. And again, he was educated as a Greek, but later de-sainted. He was sainted, and then he was de-sainted.
How convenient.
Isn't that interesting, Mike? After him, in 350 AD, came Gregory of Nyssa, who was also Greek educated, also a believer in the redemption of the world. The second African, a pagan, that became strong in the church was Augustine. Now, he was converted at 32 years old. As he started to study Greek philosophy, actually, I want us to remember this timing. 350 was the last record of someone who believed in the redemption of the world. Along about 400, the same time as a pagan god, remember that the Roman emperors were gods, a pagan god actually authorized the living god. There's an irony there, isn't it? In the same time was Augustine. At about the same time, the Vulgate, the first Latin, authorized Latin translation, occurs. And in this translation, the word aeon, meaning a predetermined period of time with a specified length and a predetermined end, was replaced by the word, the Latin word eternus, meaning eternal. No end now. The Bible also was formally accepted by the Catholic Church. So now we have it's not a canon. It wasn't canonized for another 1,000 years. But we have now an accepted body of literature, an accepted belief system that the redemption of the world was not true, but that we now had a permanent post-mortem punishment which could be escaped by the payment of money or the saying of prayers or the doing of works.
So now are you let me get this right, because I know you're going to quiz me and I got to pass the test. Are you saying that the term aeon started being translated instead of the period of time to the term. Was it everlasting or eternal, or was it both of them?
Yes, one equals the other.
So eternal and everlasting are actually, in most cases or all cases, the term aeon.
In the Latin, it's a term never-ending. It's eternal. Right. In the Greek, it's aeon. Aeon is a Greek word. Eternus is a Latin word. And by changing the predominant language of the Bible from Greek into Latin, we were then mm-hmm. able to change our doctrines,
right.
give it a Bible, the Vulgate, to back it up. And we were able to then desanitize all of these people who declared that the redemption of the world was a reality. Although they couldn't do that for another 400 years, because if you think about America, how long is it since America was founded, Michael?
It's been about 240 years now.
Okay. It took 300 years, roughly the same period of time, for the Roman Catholic Church to expunge from the memory of the living people the honor of its founders. And so it wasn't till about 300 years later, that the Roman Catholic Church could feel that they could get away with calling the founding fathers evil. And they did get away with it. The Bible was only eventually formally accepted by the Catholic Church after its complete Latinization, after the Greek church fathers and the people who could read the Greek manuscripts in the original language had been replaced by Latin-thinking, pagan-educated people. And at this time, the whole picture changed. It was everything happened at once. It was a pagan god authorized the living god. Constantine, by dint of having sharper swords, imposed his will, he was a pagan, on Christian bishops. And the whole thing just did a big old turnaround. It was very convenient. It was very self-serving. And the incredibly sad thing is this. Most people who would disagree with anything that I have said would have to say, but that's not right. And when you press them for, where isn't it right? They'd say, well, I just know it's not right. It's pathetically tragic, actually. At the same time, purgatory became necessary, and it only became necessary because now hell was eternal. There was no purgatory. There's no purgatory in the Bible. But purgatory became necessary because how can you get out of hell if you don't have a sort of a halfway house? And then from 500 through to 1500 at least, the medieval Roman Catholic Church maintained that the Bible should only be read in Latin. Greek had no force whatsoever, and was actively discouraged with lethal force any translations into local languages. And you've got to ask yourself, why would any organization demand that you could not speak in the common tongue? Here is a modern day example of it. When Russia invaded Finland, you'll probably remember from your Christian days a song called Be Still My Soul. Be still my soul, the Lord is on your side. It is an incredibly moving piece of music. It was written by a Finnish composer, became the national anthem of Finland, was so incredibly stirring that the Russians outlawed the use of it. The same as the English outlawed the use of bagpipes, because the playing of bagpipes in the Scottish mind was so stirring. So the medieval Roman Catholic Church said, sorry, you can't have the Bible in the common tongue, and it must only be actively translated by a priest or somebody who's been authorized by the church. That was in 500, right through to 1500. In 550, Origen was now declared to be a heretic. Purgatory happened before 590, but Pope Gregory actually formalizes purgatory in 590. The next big move was by Dante, who actually made hell a sort of like a modern TV show, made a play out of it, and thus he vivified hell quite incredibly. That was probably around 1300. So you have this evolution of the church that was hell-bound and determined to outlaw any concept of the redemption of the world, but it took them 500 or 600 years to do it.
And God only knows how many gallons of blood.
But once they achieved it, to this day, hell is a given. Doesn't matter that it comes out of several different words in the New Testament that mean anything but hell. And purgatory is now a given, certainly in the Catholic Church. And the concept of the redemption of the world is either scoffed at by those too ignorant to study history honestly, or simply ignored by those who are too foolish to have anything else in their minds except the thoughts of other people and digest all of their belief systems second hand, and derided by a church who thinks when you've got faith, who needs facts?
If the Bible is all about Jesus, don't you think that most churches would mention him with at least the same frequency as they mention all of their favorite dogmas and doctrine and all those rules of your particular brand of religion? Tithing, moralism, Old Testament law, abortion, gays, politics, all hail the leader, persecution, the end times, don't forget the bloody rules, God's perfect will for your life, fleeing youthful lusts, rock music, speaking in tongues, the coming kingdom, worldliness and how to escape. But those pesky rules, don't forget them. Heresy, prophecy, soul-winning missions, offerings, wrong doctrine, right doctrine. And don't forget all those bloody rules. Relationships, long hair, short hair, dyed hair, liberalism, greasy grace, Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, dispensationalism, and rules, rules, never-ending bloody rules. And Calvinism, Arminianism, a missionary service, Sunday school, swearing and cussing, besetting sins, sexual purity. Oh, and give us some more rules, won't you? False prophets, confession, dress code, mixed swimming, dancing, movies, television, dating. Oh, and did I mention the freaking rules?
Why do you suppose, Michael, it was in the interests of what was to become the Roman Catholic Church? It was actually, I suppose, a pagan church, really, seeing that it was ruled by a pagan god, remembering that the Roman emperors were God and the Roman emperor at the time, Constantine, was the person who decided to oversee the meeting in which the Bible was formally accepted in the form we have it today. Why was it in the interests of... And I suppose it was in Constantine's interest more than any church, because he seemed to subdue any opposition from any dissenting bishops. Why was it in his interests to neutralize the power of the gospel?
Well, I think the word that stands at the top of the whole category is control. I mean, if you are the emperor, there is nothing about the gospel that you want in citizenry. Of people being free and being equal. I mean, you cannot have citizenry believing that they're equal with the emperor, who the emperor is God, therefore it can't be taught that way. So I can see very clearly why the divergence away from man and God being equal came through these Latin translations, because the emperors themselves were God, therefore they had to make sure that there was a clarity of a separation between the deity and humanity. And thus, in the end result of that, giving final and total and complete control over people.
Now, I remember you saying once that the Roman Empire did not give way to nothing. It gave way to the Holy Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a friend of mine, he was head of legal counsel for the FBI for about a decade. Very brilliant person, to say the least. And he and I had many, many conversations that lasted for hours and hours and hours. And all of this gospel just made so much sense to his legal mind. He thought it was just profound. It was wonderful. He was raised in Kentucky in a very traditional Christian environment. So was his wife. And they both abandoned it completely in embracing the gospel. It was his comments that you're referring to. And he said, I read the book, The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. And he said, where in the world anyone could read that book and conclude that it was sin and homosexuality and lust and depravity that destroyed the Roman Empire. He said, they're reading a book that I didn't read. And he said, whenever a country is defeated by something, then the victors take over. And I thought, well, that's very logical. If, we go into battle with another country and whatever defeats us is what takes over. Well, it was not the most lustful Roman Empire that took over. It wasn't the most homosexual Roman Empire that took over. In fact, the empire that defeated the Roman Empire is the one that took over, and it was the most holy Roman Empire. It was Catholicism that brought down the Roman Empire. It was not perversion. That is a gross distortion of history. As this gentleman pointed out to me, he said, it's not even in the book of the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. Now, I have not read The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. He did, and he also is a historian. But he assured me that in the concept of this book, The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, the causes that are told by civilization today, he said it's obviously wrong because the ones who defeated the Roman Empire became then the Roman Empire, and it was the Catholic Church.
But that's not Christianity. That's not Protestantism. Yeah, you know, the Southern Baptists here in America, or the Methodists in England. That's certainly, surely another church.
Well, at the time it was. However, you know, Mama did it, and that's really what you have to say about all Protestantism, is that Catholicism is the mother of all Protestantism.
But we don't believe what they believe.
Well, actually, we kind of do. There are nuances of change, but they are, when you get right down to it, they are nuances. And when it comes to condemning people, believe me, the Baptists can get together with the Catholics in a heartbeat to condemn an entire part of our society. They say they disagree with each other vehemently, but when it comes to the things that define their doctrine, which is moral issues, that's where they come together. Why in the world do you think a Catholic, a Presbyterian, a Baptist, a Pentecostal can all come together on these moral issues as though their doctrine means nothing? Well, it's quite clear, because their doctrine is morally based.
Now, you're talking about things like, I don't know, abortion?
Abortion, homosexuality, alcohol, prohibition, all of these things. Goodness gracious, I mean, we would have too many to mention, I would think.
Are you saying let's just pick on the Baptists.
let's pick on the Baptists.
They're just so easy to pick on.
What do you got in your heart against the Baptists?
Okay, Presbyterians. are you saying that they're not that far removed? The apple didn't fall that far from the tree?
No, because it is obviously, and by their own declaration, their ability to come together is over morality. And their clearly defining bond is that they believe that morality is spirituality. Now, I don't care whether you run that through a priest, the pope, the bishop, Pastor John down at the Baptist church, or what you call it. When morality determines spirituality, you're all the same family.
Well, now let me just explore this for a moment. So the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not steal.
It does say that.
The Book of Hebrews says that the first covenant, including that law, thou shalt not steal, had to be totally abolished in order for the second covenant to come, correct?
This is true, yes.
Now, in the Council of Trent, the Roman Catholic Church determined that the Levitical priesthood, the one that celebrated thou shalt not steal, was naturally and understandably and totally replaced by the Roman priesthood, yes?
I'm afraid so.
And so now suddenly thou shalt not steal is back in vogue again over any, I don't know, any other covenant, or any other law, love each other or whatever. And now you're saying that Protestants and Catholics, and it doesn't really matter about your theology, what binds them together is they still believe thou shalt not steal. Am I reading you right here?
Yes, they believe that thou shalt not steal determines relationship with God. And that's why they come up with purgatories and hells and all of these things, because they don't have this blinding light coming down And everybody that steals, God zaps them on the spot. So if you don't have that happening, then you have to come up with this dreaded life after death situation that's going to take place. And please remember, for anyone to say that something is going to take place after death, as far as punishment being incurred, you're going to have to really challenge the character of Jesus when he said there'd be no more death, that in him no one would ever die again. So how are you going to bring Levitical law against someone who's just died physically who cannot die in Christ? When you come up with the concept that there will be no more death, whatever level that's on, you cannot stand up and preach to a congregation of all the penalties that will be incurred after death to people who can't die because they're in Christ. It's just ridiculous.
I suppose for me, the bottom line of agreement between, it doesn't matter who they are, Calathumpians, Presbyterians, Methodists, Catholics, Baptists, I've always been rather intrigued by the fact that, let's take again our Baptist brothers. They would tell us that the Bible was canonized around 400 AD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by saying that, they're saying a lot more than that. For example, they're saying that they're ignorant because they don't realize that the Bible was not canonized until the late 1500s. It was only formalized, that is, roughly agreed to, under threat of lethal force by a pagan god, namely the Emperor Constantine. Now, how do good Methodists, and I'm talking about nice people, I mean, these are good people. They do good things. They like good people. How do good people determine that a pagan god, namely the Emperor Constantine, could enforce what should be in the Bible the day after he murdered his wife and child? How do they support that kind of concept when it was instigated by and backed up by the Catholic Church that they say they so radically hate, that something like Northern Ireland and all of the Christian confusion there that occurred? How can they say that? I don't understand that.
Well, again, it's by necessity that they avoid these facts, because if morality ever becomes the non-denominator of spirituality, then people are going to have to think. The amazing thing about morality being the common denominator of spirituality, nobody has to think. In fact, you're just forbidden to think.
Morality says eat fish on Fridays, correct?
In Catholicism, yes.
And in Protestant morality, you can eat fish on Fridays.
Mm-hmm.
But go down a little bit deeper, and you've got to be nice to your mother. In both.
Yes.
Go down a little bit deeper yet, and you can't steal.
Mm-hmm.
If you keep going down deep enough, you're going to find a lowest common denominator upon which you can base fellowship. Is that what you're saying when you say, come abortion, come homosexuality, all of these very opposing belief systems can come together under an umbrella of morality? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. When you equate morality with spirituality, spirituality is destroyed. Any concept of spirituality based on grace and peace is completely taken out of the realm of thought.
Okay, now I'm just hearing words. I want to understand that. Can you help me understand that?
If morality is a determining factor of spirituality.
This is a morality which says you do this and you're okay.
Yes, or you do that and you're damned, which can only unify for a moment. Goodness gracious, you can bring opposing political parties together. You can bring people together for a common cause from any type of persuasion or way of thinking or sect. But the one thing that you have to acknowledge is that it is always temporary.
Morality is temporary.
The agreement is temporary. The oneness is temporary. Because the very people who unite to bring down one power, those and they only agree on one fundamental basic moral purpose, when those two groups are the source of taking down the one group, then the two groups are going to immediately go into battle against each other. You know, this actually took place right here in America and the writing of our very own Constitution. The only way that they could get the southern states and the northern states to ratify the Declaration of Independence is if they left out removing slavery from the United States. They knew beyond the shadow of a doubt, Jefferson, Adams, Franklin, they all knew, because the original Declaration of Independence spoke of the freedom of even the black man also. But they knew that they would not be able to unify the North and the South in the common purpose of getting an independence from this greater power, which was Britain. So to bring them together on one plane, they left out the whole issue of slavery out of the Declaration of Independence, which was initially in it. And by leaving it out, they brought both North and South, already divided about the issue of slavery, together to defeat the British.
And it had to come back. I mean, it had to come back to bite them in the bum later.
Yes, it as always, it does. And this, if you, man, I don't think we could say bite them in the bum. This literally ripped off the lower part of this country. Well, I mean,
you can't even begin to imagine, in a day which can never be reproduced, in a day when people had 8 kids, the greatest amount of people ever killed in battle.
Ever.
Was in this civil war over
right
exactly
here,
that same subject.
Yes, wow. From 1860 to 1865. So they brought the North and the South together to defeat Great Britain by agreeing not to disagree about slavery. So this was played out right here in this country. When you come together to have a common enemy and you've set aside your basic disagreements for a common enemy, please don't think those basic things that it's not happy days are here again. I mean, we experienced this after 9/11. There was no such thing as a Democrat or a Republican. And since then, we've had the most divisive difference between Democrat and Republican has evolved after 9/11. When we set aside our differences instead of resolving them, it is always going to come back around and become something that divides even more so than it did before the common enemy was engaged.
So the cost of doing business that way is too expensive.
It's very expensive in the long run. It's at a higher expense. You'd be better off dealing with your differences up front rather than coming up with a common enemy, because there's something about coming together to defeat a common enemy that brings greater division later on.
Tell me why, if the redemption of the world was a prevailing concept in those early years of Christianity, in the first couple of hundred years, why doesn't anyone want to speak about that? What we're talking about here is historical data.
Yes. People are taught that this is heresy.
Why do you think that Protestantism is so keen to rely on Catholic decision-making when it comes to things that are so crucial to their own existence?
That is one of the bizarre things about Protestantism, is their strict adherence to the resolves of Catholicism about basic truth, about scriptures, about even what is the scripture. Because the Catholics aren't really trying to figure out what's scripture and what's not, because it's based on not a knowledge of the Bible or the scripture. Catholicism is based on ritual. A person can go through all of Catholicism and never know what doctrine they believe whatsoever. It's simply tradition. When you get to the Protestant denominations, of course, they rely much more heavily on what they think they believe. So because that is the truth, it is bizarre that they would so readily accept what Catholicism deemed to be correct and defend it to the teeth, and yet reject Catholicism itself so resoundingly.
So they're accepting that the Bible should be the Bible in the state that the modern Bible is, mm-hmm. because the Catholic Church decided that, and they decided it by force majeure, by a majority force, not majority vote, and the people who disagreed the loudest were put to death. They can agree with that, and they can agree with everything that happened before Luther, but after Luther, they must be disagreeable with the Catholic Church. Is there something wrong? Is this my logic? Am I wrong here, mate? Am I just being stupid?
Well, it seems there was an exchange that began to take place with paganism, and Christianity reached out and embraced paganism in the form of Easter, Christmas, and the different holidays, even names that corresponded with pagan gods, even the name of Jesus. I'm not sure we even want to go there, but the term Jesus.
Zeus?
Yes, Jesus, and Son of Zeus is the form of that. There is nothing in the scriptures that would have ever given that name to who we call Jesus now. It's just not there at all.
And all of this just became Latinized? All of this paganism just became absorbed?
I think two things happened. Christianity absorbed paganism, and paganism absorbed Christianity. If they'd had a meeting, it's like, okay, you accept our holidays.
You take the west side, and we'll take the east side.
We'll accept your holidays. We'll call your holidays Christmas, even though it's the winter solstice. We'll call it Christmas, Easter, all of the ones that were originally pagan holidays, and we will apply Christian terms to them. But in return, you must take our definition of postmortem punishment, because that is what paganism embraced. And there was this unholy exchange.
Now, I've spoken to Christians who say, well, we've redeemed those holidays from the pagans. No, you didn't. You excused them. That's what you did. And what I hear Michael saying here is, yeah, Christianity never overcame paganism. Christianity absorbed paganism.
Mm-hmm.
And as time went by, the Reformation came. But Protestants and Catholics alike have never once renunciated or even acknowledged the pagan roots of their belief systems, but have blithely gone along celebrating them, enforcing them, teaching them, and even in the light of clear historical data, choose to call anyone who disagrees with them a heretic. And with all of the cash lying loose in people's pockets to be gathered, it's no wonder that any Christian denomination doesn't want to acknowledge that the very roots, the very foundations are crooked. The founder of Scientology said in the Reader's Digest, it was reported, writing for a penny a word is ridiculous. If a man really wants to make $1 million, the best way would be to start his own religion. Well, it seems to me that Catholicism and Protestantism alike heartily endorse the words of the science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard, who later started Scientology exactly as he said he would. All of these concepts are still alive and well, and yet it's only those things that have happened since the Reformation that Protestants seem to want to say, oh, that's bad, not what happened before it.
And let me make this statement here very clear as far as the Gospel Revolution. When Jehovah's Witnesses found out about all of this, they renounced Christmas, they renounced Easter, they renounced all of these things because they had found out that this was the case. So they don't celebrate these things. I had a friend telling me the other day, says it kind of ticked them off because they say they don't celebrate Christmas, but they accepted my Christmas gift but didn't give me one. So.
And they took the public holiday, huh?
Yes, they received, but they did not give. As long as they don't give, it's okay, which sounds like, you know, how else would religion do it, you know, except to give, to receive and not give. But now, let me make this clear. I'm not even suggesting, and I wouldn't stand with anything that did, that would suggest that you begin to correct this now. We're not telling you to find out Jesus's original name and start calling it that. There is something much bigger at stake here called the redemption of the world. I don't care whether you celebrate Christmas or not. In fact, I sit right here with my daughter and her fiance, and we're planning Christmas here. I told them I'll get a tree. Man, we'll decorate. I love these holidays. I think they're fantastic, and they are my traditions now, and they have nothing to do at all with the birth of Christ. But you're going to hear more gospel during Christmas time than you hear it in any other time just by walking through a department store, because Christmas songs have more gospel in them than anything you'll ever hear in church. We're not telling you to find out the original name of Jesus and stop using this pagan name.
I don't have a problem with Christmas. In fact, I'd like to come down and have Christmas with you, and I'll celebrate. I will tell you what, mate, I don't have any worries at all. But what we're doing is we're pointing out the foolishness of self-righteousness when it says we can accept this, but we can't accept that. We can go along with the fact that we're right because we split, but we accept everything that happened before the split, including who wrote the Bible, what books should be included, and who should be a saint and who shouldn't be a saint. See, Protestant religions also have some of these saints.
Yes.
And so it's just, it's idiocy. Family, this is utter foolishness. And what we're trying to do today is to simply point out this. There is something much greater than the religion which has taken over the life of Jesus the Christ.
Mm-hmm. Listen in your office, in your car, or even your neighborhood bar. You can listen with your whole family. You are.
We're not trying to deal with your beliefs or anything like that. We're just trying to, as Barris said, we're just trying to address very historical events here and how this all transpired. We're not trying to unscramble the eggs because the gospel is so powerful. You can still have Christmas. You can still put a wreath on the door. You can still hide Easter eggs. You can still do the whole nine yards. And we can go on sharing the gospel, which will prevail without taking sides on these things. See, now that's what would happen in a religious mindset, is that we'd take these historical facts and draw a line and start a battle with somebody. I'm not going to start a battle with anybody about celebrating or not celebrating Christmas. Now, we in the charismatic world drew a line in the sand and said, we will not celebrate Halloween. Because it's the only pagan holiday that Christianity didn't take over. So it remained what it was, which was All Hallows Eve, because Christianity couldn't come up with another important date, I guess, to mask over this. We, in our sect of Christianity, vowed that we would not celebrate Halloween because it was a pagan holiday.
How can you do that? You're an American, mate. It's the biggest grossing holiday in America.
I know. Now, and to show you my heart in this is that while I would not allow my kids to go trick-or-treat, I look forward to going with my grandkids because this is something that means something different to them. I just want them to understand that there's nothing spiritual about this one way or the other, celebrating it or not celebrating it, doing it or not doing it. One person's conscience says you can, one person's conscience says you can't. I want my family and the people that I love and the whole planet, at least a billion, to come to grips with an understanding that none of these things are determining factors in righteousness, that morality is not a determining factor in righteousness. When all of this happened is not a determining factor in righteousness. Whether it was Constantine or a mistranslation or any of these things, which is so vitally important to understand history, because as they say, if you don't know it, you're doomed to repeat it. And we've been repeating it over and over and over and over and over and over again, never getting to the resolving issue.
And the resolving issue is not a belief system.
Yes.
The resolving issue is not whether this is right or that's wrong. The resolving issue is that you are holy, righteous, and perfect. And that is the gospel of grace and peace.
Yes. And we can proclaim that to people who celebrate Christmas, don't celebrate Christmas, who keep the law, break the law. We can proclaim that to people who believe in Christ, don't believe in Christ. Because we know that mercy came to us through unbelief. How do you know God's had mercy upon everyone? Because God declared all to be in unbelief, and unbelief led to mercy. You see, we are all reduced to the most common denominator, and that was unbelief. And God said, I can take that unbelief and have mercy on it. And in that unbelief, he had mercy on us, and the work of the cross was carried out. And we were all redeemed through unbelief. And God himself declared, I'm going to send Jesus there. Let's raise the dead. Let's cleanse the lepers. Let's turn water into wine. We'll do all of that to show them that regardless of what is done in front of their very eyes, the most basic common denominator about human race is unbelief. But I can take that one common denominator, and by declaring them all in unbelief, I can have mercy on all. Powerful, powerful stuff. Good show.
Yeah, it is. For some reason, you just reminded me of narrow is a gate or straight is a gate and wide is the way. And I'm trying to, for wide is the gate.
And I've had this explained every way from Sunday and I still don't get it. So
what's that?
Narrow is the gate and straight is the way.
Oh, I hear. I'm going to cut me off if you don't like what I'm about to say.
Oh, no, it can be edited, so it doesn't make any difference.
I like that.
Yeah. It's just I'm not the editor, so.
I can make you say anything. You know, it's intriguing, Mike. I am thinking of the words of Jesus when he said, "Wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. Straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leads to life, and few there be that find it."
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that that the whole concept of believing is what everybody wants. Everyone wants a belief structure. Everyone wants a belief. And this is precisely why it was important, in my opinion at least, for the Roman Catholic Church to create a belief structure. They didn't have one. The Greeks, in their mindset, just simply accepted that the world was redeemed. But that was hardly a belief structure for the Latin mind. So they had to invent a belief structure. And for that, they had to invent their own Bible, the Vulgate, and their own hierarchy, the papal hierarchy, and bishops and so forth. And if you didn't like them or if they didn't like you, they just cut you off. There went Eastern Orthodox. They might cut somebody else off. There went the Protestants. Or they'll cut somebody else off. There goes the Spanish Inquisition. A few people got to go to the fire. But now, this is not to say that Protestants are any better than Catholics. Humans have to have a belief system. It seems to be something inherent in our makeup. I don't know what you call it, but we insist on being able to believe. Paul demolished this in Romans chapter 10 when he said, listen, that's an Old Testament construct.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to join the masses, wide is the gate. Plenty of people believe you need a belief system. But there is also a narrow gate. Not many people go through this gate because not many people think for themselves. But this gate incorporates the concept, as Paul said, of letting your mind be transformed. Let it be transformed by a belief system, all right, but let it be transformed by the belief that it is finished, as Jesus said. Let it be transformed not by the belief that you need to believe, but by the belief that somebody else believed for you. Let it be transformed by the belief that belief must follow facts. Facts don't follow belief. You don't believe to change facts. But once we know what the facts are, the whole world is redeemed and you with it, and you are born perfect, holy and righteous, that belief can absolutely stabilize your mind. That belief can transform your mind. That belief can free you to live the way you were built to live. How does that sound to you, Mike?
Oh, no, it's fine.
I'm not saying that I've got the right interpretation.
And the thing about it is that the thing is something like this. I mean, I still don't have a conclusion about it, but it is by people sharing these things that, you know, that we eventually get there, because inevitably, even when you say something wrong, if it is wrong, this has been my process, it provokes someone to think. I can listen to John Hagee, and through something he said that I think is absolutely stupid, he still says it in a way to where I see the truth through what was said. So I'm not concerned about whether or not it is absolutely correct or not. I don't know. I couldn't tell you that it's not. So
me either. I got no idea why. I just thought of that, and I thought, yeah. See,
let it fly.
It's like what most people believe is usually wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wide's the gate.
Yeah.
If there is one thing that the early church exemplifies it is this, that might is right, or the winners write the history. We know, thankfully, because of writings that have been left behind, that in the early church, the prevailing belief system was that of the redemption of the world. We know that in the early church, all of the people who believed that were later called heretics. But they were later called heretics by people who, by virtue of strength, might, and armies behind them, had the ability to subdue any dissenting opinions. Our question to you today is this. How long will you believe everything you've been told? And why would you believe something which is so much more hard work and so much more impossible to believe than that God loves you, considers you holy, righteous, and perfect?
Yeah, you know, Barris, the somewhere in between doctrines don't fit in anybody's religion. And the only concept that takes away the gray area in between is the gospel. It's grace and peace takes away the gray area. Because it is true. You're either righteous and holy or you're not. You're either perfect or you're not. It's like, you know, you're either pregnant or you're not. There's no degrees of. The gospel is the only thing that I know of that takes away this double-mindedness about the way we think about spirituality. And that really is what we're talking about, is what are your thoughts about spirituality? And I think we've covered a lot of things that would expose a lot of double-mindedness about spirituality, the bedfellows that self-righteousness can make and then turn right around and kill each other after they have become bedfellows. My desire has always been to get people to think for themselves. Now, a lot of people think that my desire is to get everybody to believe the gospel. Well, I know what the gospel has done in my life, and I know that it sure can't hurt you. But I know that the real key here is just to get people to think for themselves, because I'm that convinced how obvious the gospel becomes once a person is willing to think for themselves rather than to be controlled by what they've been told. I have never talked to anyone about the gospel and not been successful in communicating the message unless the problem is that they wanted to adhere what they've been told rather than to even consider. Give me someone who's even willing to consider, and the gospel will win. It is those who cannot even consider the possibility that the understanding of the gospel is going to escape them.
2 days ago, Michael, I had on my porch here a couple of wonderful, wonderful people. They belonged to our friends in the Jehovah's Witnesses, and they came just to sit and drink some cold water with me and to chat. And I asked them how they knew they were right. And I said to them, 40,000 brands of Christianity, and you're just one of them. Why do you believe that you are right? Gentlemen said, well, because we are the closest to the way Jesus taught than anyone else I've seen. I said, well, that's a pretty good reason. I said, has your group ever changed their mind on anything? And he said, well, yes, but we're always very honest. When we change our minds, we say we've changed our minds, and we're quite willing to do that. And I said, well, can you tell me, have you changed your minds for the last time? And he said, I can't say that. And I said, well, if that's not true, then you might change your minds in the future. Can you tell me what areas you're going to do that in? And if you can't, can you help me understand why I should believe anything that you're saying? Because I don't understand, if you're going to change your mind, what part should I believe and what part shouldn't I? And I said, I have to tell you this. I didn't ever know where I was with God in Christianity. Had I done enough, prayed enough? Had I done right enough? Had I done right enough long enough? Had I given out enough tracts? Had I given out enough? Had I knocked on enough doors? What is the quota? I don't know what I'm. No one ever told me what the quota was. And I lived my life like I was leaning back after lunch on the back two legs of my chair, teeter-tottering. Mm-hmm. And that's how I lived my life. Always off balance. And he's a lovely fellow, Tyrone. And I said to Tyrone, I cannot begin to tell you the peace I have found since I've embraced the gospel of grace and peace. Mm. And I used Wade Brewers. We're going to have him on in the next couple of weeks, by the way, mate.
Oh, yay.
Yeah. I used something that I learned from Wade Brewer. I said, in order to accept what you're telling me, I'd have to believe in a much lesser God.
Mm-hmm.
Because my God has redeemed the world.
Yes. We got some smart people out there, don't we?
Oh, man, we got so many of them, too. And Wade, we're coming for you, buddy.
Gospel Revolution.
So it is that we must leave you, folks. We really appreciate every single one of our listeners, and we especially appreciate those who, with their financial support, make sure that this weekly PowerCast goes out on time. If you'd like to join them in increasing our coverage of this gospel of grace and peace, call our office. The number is coming up soon. And speak to Jeffrey. If you'd like to leave a message for the show, simply telephone us at area code 234. Number is 5640971. Our new office number, please make a note of this, our office number has changed. Our new office number is area code 321-220-4373. That is area code 321. The number is 220-4373. Our web address is www.gospelrevolution.com, and we are always up for a Facebook chat at Friends of Mike Williams and the Gospel Revolution. Remember, no religionists were harmed in the making of this program, and thanks to Marcel Roos in the Netherlands, all the gospel, all the time, is being broadcast 24-7 at gospelrevolution.radiostream123.com. And so it is good night from myself, Beres Bartlett from the GR Studios in Nashville, Tennessee.
And it is good night from Michael Williams. And I have to say thank you, Beres, for the history lesson. My goodness, what a wonderful class we've had tonight. And I learned a lot. Just makes the gospel make that much more sense, regardless of whether you deal with the history of Christianity and religion and Catholicism or what the subject happens to be. The gospel always becomes this bright and shining star that we can all look to have perfect navigation for the heart.
So remember to join us again next week, same time, same channel, where we're going to do the same thing all over again.
Only better. Shoulders.
Use only as directed. Absolutely no warranty expressed or implied. Contents under pressure. Use in a well-ventilated area. Do not use while operating a motor vehicle or heavy equipment. No user serviceable parts inside. One size fits all. Parental guidance suggested. Severe pain has sometimes been reported and in rare cases, death. Limited time offer. Call now to ensure your prayer blessing. This supersedes all previous notices. This information is subject to change without notice. At all participating churches near you.
Gospel Revolution.
Thank you so much, Barris. Love you.
Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye, friend.
Bye.
Okay.